Welcome to Multilingual Montessori, a podcast where we discuss multilingualism, multiculturalism, and raising children from a Montessori perspective. I'm Gabrielle Kutkov, an AMI Montessori guide and TESOL instructor with a master's in child studies, and I'm the founder of Multilingual Montessori. You can find me on Instagram at multilingual.montessori and at multilingualmontessori.org. My guest today is Zill Yeager, they/them, a Montessori educator, consultant, and coach with a passion for literacy and a commitment to anti-bias, anti-racist education. They are Montessori trained at the 3-6 and 6-12 levels with multiple literacy certifications. They believe that classrooms should be spaces of joy, critical engagement, and community-minded learning. An advocate for literacy learning, Zill is devoted to translating research into effective classroom strategies. They love supporting teachers, caregivers, and schools to empower children in their learning. In this conversation, Zill shares insights into the sciences of reading and how we can support literacy learning in Montessori environments according to the latest research. They also share their memories of going to Montessori school as a child and their experience being the parent of a child attending a public Spanish language immersion elementary school in Portland, Oregon. Zill is offering listeners of the Multilingual Montessori podcast a 15% discount on their shop with the code LITERACY. You can find all of their literacy materials for purchase at zillyeager.com. Okay, let's get into it. Here's my conversation with Zill.
I am Zill Yeager, they/them. I live on the unceded territories of the Chinook and Cowlitz people, which is also known as Portland, Oregon. And I work in the Montessori world as an educational consultant, a tutor, a coach, and primarily in the area of literacy.
Awesome. Well, we're going to talk all about literacy, but first, I would love to talk about your memories of going to Montessori schools as a child, because I think you said you've been in Montessori since the age of 3, which is amazing. So what do you remember about Montessori when you were little?
Yeah, I was reflecting on this, and so I wrote some notes down, but I have a lot of visual memories. Like, I can actually picture what my classroom as a 3-year-old looked like and just kind of like how it felt to move through that classroom, which felt very peaceful. I definitely had that feeling of like, this is my space. I remember flower arranging. I remember the buckle frame. I remember sunflower seeds and milk for snack every day. And I actually do remember learning how to read. I think I was like 4.5. And those modern curriculum press books like Max and Dunebug, if you've ever seen those. And I just remember getting stuck on the word the over and over and going and asking my primary teacher, what's this word again? And then as I was older, just remembering writing lots of studies about miscellaneous like female historical figures, like Eleanor of Aquitaine and Amelia Earhart. Yeah.
How old were you when you stopped going to Montessori?
I was 12 in 6th grade. I did have a little brief intermission of 1st and 2nd grade where I went to a traditional school. I was hyperlexic, so I was a fluent reader reading chapter books in 1st grade, and this was 1988. And so I sat in the hallway while everyone else learned how to read. I sat in the hallway.
Aww.
At my public school. And after 2 years of that, my parents were like, this kid needs a little more socialization. Sent me back to Montessori.
So when you transitioned into traditional school in 6th grade or after 6th grade, what do you remember about that experience?
Feeling deep shame about liking to learn, because that like was not something that was okay. I was definitely teased for getting excited about learning. And that was not my experience in a Montessori setting. And that was kind of like what life as a like a student was like then for me through high school. And then when I went to college, I got to like be around my fellow nerds again.
Oh, nice. I went to a small liberal arts college, and I often talk about how that is very similar to Montessori in that you get to choose your own path and take whatever classes you want within some restrictions, but not very many.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a similar experience.
So what made you decide to get your Montessori training? Was that something that you always had thought about doing?
It wasn't. I studied anthropology in undergraduate and was very passionate about finding work where I could see change happening on a regular daily basis. That felt really important to me, to be part of some sort of change making. And so my primary teacher, so the teacher I had when I was three, reached out to me because she was still a family friend when I graduated college. And she recruited me into a Montessori charter school in Phoenix, Arizona. So I went and did my 3-summer program when I was 21. And in those interim years was teaching an older elementary classroom without full training.
Wow.
Which was a wild experience.
So did you do training for 3 to 6 or 6 to 12?
That was my 6 to 12 training. I then, after a couple of years at that charter school and some travel in the interim, I eventually made it to a private school, Marin Montessori School in California. And while I was teaching there, a lower elementary classroom, I discovered I just not have all the information or tools that I needed. And so I went back and did my 3 to 6 training while I was there.
So when you did your 3 to 6 training, even though you had, you know, been in 3 to 6 as a child and then had worked as an adult with elementary students, what do you remember being surprised about or, I don't know, interested in, particularly when you were in that training?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was most interested in this idea of an age of transition. So I did a lot more reading of Dr. Montessori's original texts during that time. And if you go back, I think it's in the Advanced Montessori Method Volume 1, but she talks about like basically ages 6 and 7 as a separate thing, or kind of like this fluid moment, this age of transition. And I really start to think about, like, as a lower elementary guide, okay, just as we have transition materials for the 3-year-old child or the 2.5-year-old child who's coming into the CASA space, what are the corollaries? Like, what are the transition materials that you would have for a little bit of time to support that child in feeling oriented to the elementary classroom and settled? So I was really interested in that and like that kind of that feeling of continuum, because I think so many Montessori schools, it's pretty rigid, or there's this feeling of like, if you don't have the primary, then you can't access elementary. And I just think we have to create more access, because you're going to encounter children who haven't had the primary, and we still want to welcome and love them in our elementary classrooms.
Yeah. That reminds me of when I was a primary guide, and my assistant and I would often talk about the 6-year-olds who were still in our environment, but maybe sort of starting to get into that second plane, and they would do something and we'd be like, oh, they're second planing.
Uh-huh.
You can start to see glimmers of it come through.
Yeah. And I think that was another kind of exciting and surprising thing for me in my primary training, is that I really thought, okay, primary means individual work, no group work, but there's actually a fair amount of exercises that can be done in a very social way to meet some of those characteristics and needs of that older primary child, early elementary child. So I think we got to get our Montessori elementary and primary folks talking to each other more.
Yeah, this conversation is going to make me want to get my elementary training, I can tell.
It's pretty awesome.
I know, recommend. I always think, I think a lot of Montessorians feel this way. If I had all the time and money in the world, I would love to get trained in every level. It's just, it's fascinating, the scope of human development that you can understand. But
yeah, well, or like, I am very, especially as I've started learning about literacy and thinking about professional development for teachers, I like want to go back and retake different trainings from different trainers to like see like what is out there, like what's being taught, how is it being taught, what are our methodologies, what's the research is based on and why. And yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
More training.
Yes. So let's talk a little bit about literacy and reading. So listeners might be familiar with the term science of reading, either from being educators or it's kind of a buzzword in the news. There's been a lot of reporting lately about phonics-based approaches versus different approaches. And Sold a Story is a podcast that I just finished listening to, but came out last year, that talks about this issue. So it's kind of a hot topic right now. So give us some background. What is the science of reading?
The definition that the Reading League came up with is that the science of reading is a vast interdisciplinary body of scientifically based research about reading and issues related to reading and writing. There's a couple of things in there that I think are important to tease out. One is that science is not static. It's always changing and evolving. Two, when they're defining this, they don't actually define what reading is. And I just went to a webinar, two webinars, Monday and Tuesday night, with Lorena Herrmann and Shauna Coppola. And I am like really kind of sparked right now and thinking a lot about the discourse of the science of reading. They shared some critiques of that discourse, of that like dominant discourse, including that it makes it seem like there's only one specific way to teach reading, right? Or that the science of reading can only be distilled to phonics. Or that when we're thinking about reading, like what does reading mean? Is it only print reading? And why is print reading maybe elevated above other sorts of reading of many different kinds of texts, whether that be graphic novels or audiobook, you know, listening, or just thinking about multiple literacies and multiple ways of understanding and communicating with our fellow humans. And I think that this all kind of like gels for me as I'm continuing to learn about it together with Montessori, because I think our Montessori Elementary Cosmic Education Framework allows us to support children, empower children to express themselves in many, many different ways, right? They don't have to just write. They can draw, they can act, they can sing, they can build dioramas, they can make timelines. There's lots of different ways for them to express themselves. And just as there are many ways for them to express themselves, there's many ways for them to also read, quote unquote, there are air quotes around that read, right? Through listening to stories, that be a way of quote unquote reading. And so all that to say, like neither Shauna Coppola nor Lorena Herrmann were saying like, don't teach children encoding and decoding skills. No, still teach that, of course, but that the science of reading discourse is, it's very loud and narrow in some ways. And if you trace it back to the funding streams and like which publishing companies are then making money off of it, if you trace it back to like what policies are being pushed and why, you're going to find things that are kind of similar to the pendulum swing that happened 20 years ago, right? Where there was like the balanced literacy push, or 30 years ago, and all the money that was funneled to those folks. And so who then gets continually disadvantaged? People, the children who lack the resources to access the kinds of information that maybe they should be accessing. I think instead what the argument here is to support teachers in better understanding the information they need to understand, so that they can leverage and decide like how to teach it, right? Like trust teachers to individuate to the children in front of them, because those teachers are the ones having those relationships. That's my understanding thus far. I'm still reading. There's an article by Richard Milner that I have yet to read. It is a paid article, so you'll have to purchase it. And then there's another article by Lee Patel on decolonizing.net that's called What I Learned from Debating the Science of Reading for More Than 20 Years Ago is Still True. And that was just published 2 days ago. Particularly of interest to your listeners, potentially, Gabrielle, is that there's not a lot of research done about print reading and phonics specifically for multilingual learners. And even in the training that I took this summer, which is the Lexia Letters training, multilingual learners, it was like always this like little side bubble or this like, and this is what you do to support multilingual learners, like as an aside, as opposed to like, what's the best practice for everybody? And let's center the children who maybe need the most access first.
I really hope that the research, expands for multilingual readers, because so much of the world is multilingual. But what I hear from a lot of adults is that they didn't learn to read in all of the languages that they speak. And it really is different. I mean, as somebody who learned, like I learned like my second and third languages as an adolescent and young adult, you know, so I wasn't fluent in two languages as a child. So I never had the experience of, you know, learning to read in different languages. I knew how to read. And then when I learned another language, I simultaneously learned that language and was reading in that language at the same time. But it is a different experience. And for people who maybe don't speak more than one language, it is surprising that if you speak a language, you don't also know how to read in it necessarily. So I really hope that that field is growing.
No, absolutely. I mean, especially if we're thinking about affirming children's identities and affirming children's home languages, supporting children in like many home languages, actually some home languages don't have a print-based text, right? So like we have to affirm that as well. But for those that do, like supporting children and having that access to that deep part of their individual culture feels really important.
Yeah. I feel like I bring this up in multiple podcasts. It just came up in a recent interview, but one of the nerdiest things about me is that I have a collection of The Little Prince in many different languages. And some of these languages that have been recently published are regional languages and dialects, especially in Europe. I mean, not as much in the United States, but many of these languages are just spoken and are not written languages, but translators have taken it upon themselves to translate into how they would say these words. You know, there are no other texts that they're drawing from except their own experiences and their own regional or dialectical language that they speak, and then what they think somebody speaking these words would say. So it's fascinating. I've spoken to a couple friends, and, you know, I've shown some of these copies to some friends. One was a friend from a city called Livorno in Italy. So it was Livornese. Another friend was from Hong Kong. So it wasn't Cantonese. It was like, or maybe it was Cantonese. That one, yes, that one was Cantonese, but Cantonese and Mandarin are not two different written systems, but this book was the Cantonese dialect. That was the distinction. And so both of them, I remember their reactions being like, this is crazy. This is like actually how we talk, but it's nothing that they had ever seen in print before. So yeah, it is, if we can imagine other texts like for younger children, being able to see those words in print, that is so affirming.
Yeah. Yeah. That is really interesting. I love that story. I would love to see those.
Yeah, I'll send you some screenshots. So, talking about the connection between Montessori and literacy and what we may or may not continue calling the science of reading, I just went back to my primary album my language album, and we talked about something called total reading. Now, I did training in 2016 to 2017, so I don't know if they've changed it since then, but at the time, the Montessori view of total reading has three branches. There is decoding or mechanical reading, which we might refer to as phonics. Then there's understanding meaning, and then there's appreciation of the style of writing. So tone and syntax and all of that stuff. Is that what your training was like? And how did they talk about that in the elementary training?
Yeah, so my training also used this idea of total reading. And if you look at a lot of the reading models from the sciences of reading, I'm going to call it the sciences, right? Because there's lots of them. That really like connects well with those reading models, right? That it's not just about phonics, but it is also about connecting to comprehension and background and vocabulary, all of those other pieces of meaning making that are really important, as well as, you know, sentence structure and those other pieces. That is then carried through in elementary. We expand on the farm game, and we really like delve into all of those parts of speech. It's lively, it's engaged, it's like performed. And something I found really interesting was I was listening to a podcast with a literacy expert named Lynn Stone, who wrote Reading for Life. And she was talking about ways to like personify parts of speech. And I like wanted to reach through my phone and be like, do you know about Montessori? She's like, when we personify our parts of speech, we like make them real for the children. I was like, yes, I know. Like that big black triangle, it's the pyramid. That's the noun. yeah, we continue that work. And I think that that's really powerful for children. When I work with teachers, I really encourage them to dig into sentence analysis. I think that in elementary, that's like one of those lessons that can be kind of forgotten, but actually is so juicy and lets children think about how do I want to say what I want to say in a written form, right? Let me write a sentence and mix up all the parts. Yeah, so there's that thread from primary to elementary, and there's threads of Montessori that really do, you know, follow the models that reading scientists have kind of put forth. That said, I do think that there are some areas in which our Montessori approach could be supported, where teacher training could better help educators know the different patterns of English spelling, could support educators in having more variety for how to repeat skills when a child doesn't spontaneously burst into reading as we're told they're going to. And that can be for a variety of reasons, right? Like maybe a child is on the dyslexia spectrum. Maybe a child is brand new to your classroom. We don't know what else is going on. There can be a lot of reasons why. And so it's less about the why and rather like, what do we do? Like, how do we support this child in front of us? Yeah. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like absolutely. I rambled a bit.
No, it's so interesting. I often think about how we teach grammar and sentence structure and sentence analysis in Montessori and how that's not how I learned. I don't remember. I remember being little and my mom showing me how to diagram a sentence. And that was not something that I was learning in public school in the 90s. I was asking her recently when I just finished listening to Sold a Story. I was like, how did I learn to read? I was like, did they do phonics? Did they do whole reading or whatever the other type is referred to? And she couldn't remember. But whichever, you know, way it was, I learned to read. But it is just like the way that we learn math in or teach math in Montessori is so hands-on and concrete, using those shapes and using the charts that we use for sentence analysis, reading analysis. It makes it so concrete for children, and they're really able to get those building blocks and then use reading and writing as a tool to express themselves. And I think in a way that maybe other approaches don't have as intuitively.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
So you, in your work, talk a lot about an ABAR framework for education. So I would love to hear about the connection between literacy and language and that ABAR framework.
Yeah. So the ABAR framework, ABAR stands for Anti-Bias, Anti-Racist, and the framework was developed by Louise Derman Sparks and Julie Olson Edwards. And there are four goals in that framework. And I have been a really longtime learner from Britt Hawthorne and also Tiffany Jewell. And so if you're looking to learn more, I'd really recommend your listeners check both of those folks out. Those four goals are identity, diversity, justice, and action. And so when I think about literacy and I think about our identities, right, being able to understand who I am, I might do that by listening to stories that my family is telling me, but I also might do that by reading books, right, or looking at picture books. I might do that by hearing songs that kind of like are affirming to my specific culture. When I think about diversity, literacy is so important to be able to connect and understand and more deeply relate to the wide diversity of human experience. When we think about both justice and action, unfortunately, our society is set up as a print-based society right now. I do think it's starting to shift, right? There's a lot more video, there's a lot more audio, but the way that our laws are set up, the way that commerce and capitalism is set up, it is set up as a print-based society. And so in order to both recognize and point out what, you know, what inequities there are, so that justice strand, you have to be able to read print. And in order to maybe push against those, you need to be able to write, right, or speak that same kind of language. And so for me, those are those connections. I also think that it's important that children know that they can be storytellers of their own truth, right? And so that writing and reading are not the only ways that they have as avenues to express themselves. They have lots of different ways to express themselves. And so to me, that feels very aligned with an anti-bias and anti-racist approach, because we want to affirm all their many ways of being in the world, of being in their school and their classroom and with their peers.
Yeah. And it also makes me think about what you were talking about before with multilingualism and, you know, affirming all of the languages a child might speak, all of the identities they might come to us with, and not, you know, of course, every educator can't speak every language, but finding ways to learn from the students in our classes and learn words in their languages, invite cultural traditions and foods and songs and stories from different cultures, I think is a great way to bring multilingualism and affirm it in the classroom too.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a book that I read this summer from the NIEYC. I'm looking up the title. It's called Literacy Learning for Infants, Toddlers, and Preschoolers. And while not from a Montessori framework at all, I really valued the emphasis that the authors put on affirming and centering multilingualism. And it was from that book that I learned the term translanguaging. I don't know if you're familiar with that term.
Yes, I am. There was just maybe a couple days ago an article on the AMS blog about translanguaging, and I haven't read it yet. The tab is open on my computer, but I will link it in the episode description. But do you want to give us a definition of what translanguaging is?
Sure. Translanguaging is the idea that rather than code switching, language is actually more permeable than that. So it might be something like, estoy parqueando, right? I'm parking my car, right? So like a child who is living in Miami, like that could be something that is like just very much part of that like blended English Spanish way of speaking. And so again, like affirming like that third, like the third language almost that's like coming about, and that children who are growing up multilingual might effortlessly, you know, move from one language and into the other and then back again to the other language all in one sentence. And supporting and affirming and you know, upholding that, I think is really awesome.
Yeah, I love that. I think that idea of fluidity and even of almost like a third language is important to keep in mind because people are multidimensional and so is the language that they use.
Well, and humans create language, right? So it's constantly evolving and changing.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So what is some language that parents and educators can keep in mind when approaching topics like race, gender, and bias with children?
I think rather than, you know, specifically talking about those terms, I would instead support parents and educators to think about that framework, right? And checking out Brit Hawthorne's book, Raising Anti-Racist Children, or Tiffany Jewell's book, The Anti-Racist Kid, are both really great frameworks and resources to help guide, like, how do you support your child in developing their identity? I have a almost 7-year-old, and so she just started first grade, and so we started our identity journal as kind of part of our like back to school work. So every day or two, we'll do a little work in our identity journal, and that's things like drawing her self-portrait or writing affirmations about all the things that she loves about herself, or like learning more about the stories about herself and her background that she wants to know. Practice writing down like different facts about kind of her social identity. So those are those things like race and ethnicity and gender, right? And but I'm approaching it from I'm gonna give that label later when she's ready for it, and right now give her the experience first of saying like, yes, you are a white person, and you are Mexican and German and Norwegian. That's your ethnicity, right? So helping her understand all the different layers of who she is.
Yeah. And speaking of Britt's book, I'm not a parent, but one thing that I really liked in her book was she talks about really starting from a place of learning as the adult that we all learn and change and do better when we know better. And I really liked that approach of being open as the parent and not coming at it from a place of this is what I know, and I'm telling it to you, which is also very in line with Montessori.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely have made those mistakes in the past of like approaching topics like race from a very heavy place rather than centering joy first. And now that I know that, that's what I'm doing instead.
Speaking of ways that we can support educators. What are your favorite resources to recommend to educators?
I've named a few. Honestly, Instagram. I learned so much from Instagram, and I think just continuing to connect with the folks that you're interested, like that, you know, share your interests that help you learn more, that maybe point you in different places. Yeah, that's what I would say.
Who are your favorite Instagrammers to follow?
I mean, definitely Brit Hawthorne. I also, though, learn a lot from a variety of different literacy teachers. So there's and like non-Montessori folks, and I try to read even on Instagram everything I read with like a lens of like, and how would this work in a Montessori space? And if they're saying something that is like backed by research, I'm the kind of person who then wants to find the name of the study and go and read the study. And so I just say that as a caveat, because I think that there's a lot of information out there. Again, this is kind of what I was talking about earlier with the discourse around the science of reading, where it becomes this this game of telephone, right? And I don't want to be part of that. I probably am part of that, despite my best intentions. But I really encourage people to actually like go read things themselves. That said, with that big caveat, I really like Campbell Creates Readers. I've learned a lot from her. There's an Instagram person named Orton Gillingham Mama, and I've learned a lot from her as well. And then Webster's Dictionary, good old Webster. They've got such great just information about the meanings of words that I get a huge kick out of.
They have a really great social media presence. The Merriam-Webster Instagram is on fire. I like it.
Yeah.
So what have your own experiences been like with learning new languages?
I learned French in middle school and high school, and remember barely anything of it. And then in college, I studied Hindi, and I studied abroad in India. And at one point, like, I could have a decent conversation in Hindi. And then all of that was like eclipsed when I went and spent some time in Guatemala and studied Spanish. And my experience there, I think, was like my strongest language experience, because I didn't know any Spanish before. I had studied other languages, so I had some kind of basis. And from French, I knew, you know, the Romance language structure. However, not knowing any at all, and then sitting down, and I would sit one-on-one with my language teacher for 5 hours a day and just speak for wow. 5 hours a day. And my, you know, my other two language experience, like learning experiences, were much more, you know, traditional school-based setting sort of experiences. And when I studied Spanish, I think that immersion approach really works, because of all the languages, it's the only one that actually kind of stuck. It's still pretty rusty, but I can get around using it. Yeah.
Wow. What a great experience. How long were you there for?
That first time it was 4 months. Yeah. And then, Wow. Yeah. And then I went back. I became really close. I don't know if you know this about me. I became really close friends with my Spanish teacher. Her name is Shirley Ancor. And she is a child psychologist, and we were the same age. So we were like getting along, and she was like, child psychology, tell me about this Montessori thing. So we spent a lot of time talking about Montessori. And then, of course, she became really interested in Montessori. And so I ended up supporting her in going to get her primary training.
Wow.
And then me and another Montessori person ended up supporting her and working with her to help her start her school there. And so she started a primary school at first, Mi Casita Montessori. I actually did my student teaching there for my primary training. And then she ended up going back to get her elementary training and started an elementary program. Yeah.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, that was
when you did fun. Practice teaching in her classroom, were you speaking in Spanish with the children or English?
I was speaking in Spanish. Yeah. It was still kind of at the beginning of her program. So she had, I think she only had like 2 or 3 5-year-olds. So I ended up not giving like a ton of later lessons. So it was more like analyzed movements. And a lot of the children, like Spanish was their second language as well. Many of them spoke either Mam or Quiche as their first language. And so like maybe they were used to like iffy Spanish. I would call my Spanish iffy.
You were all kind of learning Spanish in the same level. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. What a wonderful experience. So you shared that your daughter's school is a Spanish immersion school. So what has that been like so far, both for her and for you?
She is in week four, and previously she was in an English speaking Montessori primary classroom. So not only is it a big shift in terms of the languages being spoken, but it's also a big shift in terms of just being in a traditional setting. It's our neighborhood public school. She loves it, and she's bringing home so much more Spanish, and it's just exciting to see her, not get as frustrated when I do try to speak Spanish with her. So that's I think it's really great for her to be exploring, not only learning a second language, but being able to explore that part of her identity and kind of feel more connected. She'll be able to speak with her abuela, who only speaks Spanish. And so that's part of why I was like, I really want you to speak Spanish. And I don't think it's
Yeah.
going to happen if we only do it at home.
Wow, that's amazing. Was that a program that you had to seek out, or was it pretty readily available in the neighborhood?
It's really interesting, actually. So PPS only has two schools like this school, and this is one of them. This is a neighborhood only school, meaning that like if you live in the neighborhood, then you can join unless you're a native Spanish speaker. So native Spanish speakers have access to it, and from all across the city. And so the entire school is dual immersion. Other Portland public schools, they'll have like part of the school will be dual immersion and part of the school will be the English program. And it creates these kind of divisions and binaries that feel weird. So the entire school is dual immersion. The model it follows is that it's 90-10 Spanish English in kindergarten, eventually moving to 50-50. So right now in first grade, my daughter has 80% of her day spoken in Spanish. And we did have to, she had to test in at the first grade level because even though we live in the neighborhood, she didn't start at her kindergarten year. And so she did have to take a Spanish test
Oh,
last
wow.
spring, which was, she was very nervous. I was probably very nervous. But she did okay.
Oh,
She
that's
knew
great.
enough to make the jump.
Oh, good. Well, you'll have to keep me posted on how the year goes. That's very exciting that she's in that program. Did you say it goes up to middle school, or what year does it end?
This school goes to fifth grade, and then once you're in the dual immersion program in PPS, you can follow it all the way through high school. So
Wow.
she's kind of like in a Spanish track now.
Wow. That's really amazing. I think in New York City there are some options like that, but I don't know that they continue through high school. So
Really?
I'll have to look into it. It's been a while since I looked into it. I know that a lot of, depending on the neighborhood and all of that, I think it's hard for English speakers to get in. They're always looking for more children who are not English speakers, because a lot of English parents, speaking parents, want their children in the dual programs. So I think there's always, not enough spots for all the children that want it, but they want it to be as 50-50 as, depending on the model, as 50-50 as it can be, so that the children will speak to each other in both languages. But I'll have to look into it and see. New York City public high school selection is like, picking as like applying for college. It's crazy. So I don't know if you can guarantee a spot in a Spanish immersion high school, but now I'm very curious. I'm going to look into it.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
mean, it sounds similar in Portland. There's a lot, like especially the like two like the places where there's two programs within one school, there's a lot of competition. So you'll end up with like classes of 30 in the Spanish program and then classes of like 15 in the English program. And again, like facing that same challenge. What I really appreciate about my daughter's school is that they very, very explicitly state like we're here to support native language speakers, and we're going to provide like access and supports for children who have the least resources first. That is what we're doing here. And I'm like, yes, I am here to support that.
Yeah, that's great. What kind of support do they have for parents? Do they offer any language support in either Spanish or in English for parents?
Yeah, they're, well, everything is translated. So everything, like every single parent event I've attended has been bilingual. And so all the school staff are bilingual or multilingual. And there's also a group specifically for native Spanish speakers called Cafe Español that they, that I haven't attended. It's not for me. But my understanding is that it's to support families in like connecting with one another or connecting to resources if they need to, or to, if Spanish speakers are not also English speakers and are wanting like English language support. I think that there are like classes that they organize or support for families. Yeah. So there is a lot that's kind of offered at the school, and yeah, I'm excited to like continue to learn more.
Yeah. That's great to hear about all the options and the support that they offer. I did a presentation, like a parent education presentation for a middle school at, or was it elementary and middle school in the Denver public school system. And it was a dual language Montessori public school. And they had simultaneous translation in the Zoom meeting, which was so cool. So they had the translator and she came in and she went into a breakout room. And I don't know how it worked on the kind of like what viewers end, if they, I think they were able to like see the visuals but hear her. So I don't know how that worked, but I thought that was such a cool feature that it wasn't like they had to watch a recording later. It was there in the moment. So
yeah. Awesome. I'll also say, like, all of the parent events I've attended, Spanish is spoken first. And I also really appreciate that because, like, it's helpful, even though, like, I can kind of pick up and understand a little bit what's saying. I really appreciate, like, having the experience of not fully understanding, right, first, and experiencing that. And then being spoken to in English after.
Yeah. And something so subtle, like going back to this connection between multilingualism and ABAR work, something as subtle as like having English be first and then Spanish, or on a dual language pamphlet, having English be on the top and Spanish on the bottom, or the English words are a little bigger than the Spanish. It's so subtle, but it really has an impact. So when that's flipped, it can be very affirming, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think it really, the principal who's here has made such strong efforts to prioritize native Spanish family, like native Spanish speaking families. And I really, really, really appreciate that that's his impetus and push at the school.
Yeah. Wow. What a great experience. I hope you'll update me on how things are going with your daughter. So we have talked about a lot of topics. Is there anything else that we haven't covered that you wanted to say?
Yes, I am starting a monthly virtual gathering. I'm calling it the Lit Lab. And so for folks who are signed up for my mailing list, if they would like to, for folks who are interested, you can sign up for my mailing list by going to my website, which is just www.zilljaeger.com. And I'll be starting in October, and we'll just choose a topic every month. I will share a little bit of like presentation about some ideas about how to approach that topic, and then we'll have time to talk as a community. To start, and keeping it pretty small, just 25 spaces, so that we can kind of truly have more of a workshop feel and have people feel like they can share out and ask questions and have a conversation about the topic.
Well, I will definitely link to your website in the episode description so people can sign up for your mailing list through that. And thanks for being here today. This is such a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Gabriella. It's really, really great to meet you, and I was excited to chat about all things literacy and multilingual education with you.
Thank you again to Zill for joining me on the podcast. You can find links for everything that Zill and I referenced in the show notes, which are linked in the episode description. Don't forget that you can take 15% off everything in Zill's shop with the code literacy at zilljaeger.com, and you can find Zill on Instagram at zilljaeger. You can find me on Instagram at multilingual.montessori and on my website at multilingualmontessori.org. You can find links to everything in the episode description. Make sure you're subscribed to the Multilingual Montessori podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you're listening right now. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave a rating and review on whatever app you're listening through. It helps more people find the show, and I really do read every single one. Another wonderful way to support the podcast is to share it with someone who you think would enjoy it as well. Thanks again for listening, and see you next time.